And Shri asked me to talk about soft gamma ray repeaters in a workshop about gamma ray burst, and therefore about the relation between short gamma ray repeaters and gamma ray burst. And the reason is, especially the giant flares from these soft gamma ray repeaters. The reason is that giant flares from soft gamma ray repeaters looks, they have many similarities to gamma ray burst. Most promptly are the short flash of gamma ray that we observe at the beginning of the flare and the afterglow which follows it. And there are two questions which I want to address which relate this phenomena to GRBs. The first is derived by the theoretical motivation that if we see something which is similar, maybe the evolution of the flare is similar to the evolution of GRB. So we know that the progenitor is different, or we believe that we know that the progenitor is different, but maybe all the progenitor is doing is just putting the energy in the right space, in the right place, and the evolution of the energy from the progenitor all the way until we see what we see is similar. So this is the first point that I would like to address. I will claim that probably not. And then the main question that will raise, if it is not, is what is the energy source of the afterglow that we observe in the soft gamma ray repeaters. Second, as I said, since they look the same, we can, from observational point of view, we can mistake a soft gamma repeater as a GRB. And this will lead to the second question, is what is the rate of giant flares, or the relation of extragalactic giant flares to short GRBs? What is the fraction of the population? Is it all the population? Is it a small fraction? So these are the two questions I would like to address. First, I will give a short review about soft gamma ray repeaters and about the observations which are relevant to this question. So today there are three known soft gamma ray repeaters in our galaxy, one in the LMC, and soft gamma ray repeaters have three modes of three characterizing emission modes. First one is persistent emission. Every given time, there is an emission of X-rays with a luminosity of about 10 to the 35 Hertz per second. Within this emission, there is a periodicity. The periodicity is several seconds. And also, a spin down can be measured. And the spin down, the lifetime derived from the spin down, is about 1,000 to 10,000 years. Then there are repeating soft gamma ray flares. This is where the name comes from. Every once in a while, these objects produce flares with an energy ranging around 10 to the 41 Hertz. The duration of the flare is about 0.1 second, and again, these flares are very soft gamma rays, about 10 kV, mostly thermal spectrum. And then there are mini-giant gamma ray flares. I call them mini-giant first because Shri likes this kind of notations, and second, because these two mini-giant flares were observed before the one that is now called the giant flare in two other objects. The evolution of this flare is very similar to the evolution of to the flare that I'm going to talk about today. First, there was a very bright spike. The spike took about 0.1 second, and the energy in this spike in the two previous mini-giant flares was about 10 to the 44 erg. And after the spike, there was a pulsating tail in X-rays. The spike was much harder than the tail. And in this tail, there was the same periodicity observed in the persistent emission is observed also in the tail. The duration of the tail was several hundred seconds. And in these two mini-giant flares, the energy in the tail was comparable to the energy in the spike, 10 to the 44 Hertz. In the giant flare, which I will talk about, the main difference is that the spike was much more energetic, two orders of magnitude more energy in the spike than in these two mini-giant flares. Now, the common wisdom about the progenitor of these events is a magnetar. It was suggested in 92 by Duncan and Thompson and by Paczynski. And the idea that this is an isolated, slowly rotating neutron star. And at the time that they suggested this progenitor, the spin down was not measured yet. Later, the spin down was measured. And indeed, if you look at the PP dot diagram of the pulsar, you can see that this part of the diagram with a very large P and very large P dot lies magnetars with magnetic field, which is indeed between 10 to the 14 to 10 to the 15 Gauss, which is where the name is coming from. Now, why do we need such high magnetic field? For many reasons. The most obvious one is that there is not enough energy, not enough rotational energy in the in the magnetar to explain the variety of the emission that we observe from these sources. The rotational energy is about 10 to the 45 Hertz. With a magnetic field of 10 to the 15 Gauss, we have an energy reservoir of about 10 to the 47 Hertz, and this is a reservoir for all, both for the persistent emission and for the flares. Here I just wrote the grand picture of what is the process which produces flares. So according to this theory, the process is a global shift in the crust, like a starquake, but on a global scale in the magnetar, the crust is breaking down because of tension of magnetic field from the interior of the star. And these shifts cause one way to produce this amount of energy is by global reconnection of the magnetic field in the magnetosphere of the star. And this is the energy source. And we have enough energy definitely for the mini giant flares, and probably just barely for the giant flare as well. Now, two timescales in this flare, at least in the initial spike, which might tell us something about the source. The first is the rise time of the spike. The initial spike is rising very fast, about millisecond, and this is supposed to be corresponding to the alpha crossing time of the magnetosphere, where the speed is the speed of light. And the duration of the spike, about 0.1 second, supposed to correspond to the crossing time, the alpha crossing time of the interior, where the density is much higher, the velocity is smaller than the speed of light. It takes about 0.1 second to cross the star. So this was just a short review.
What do you mean by the crossing time magnetosphere? I mean,
you said
the magnetosphere is really big, right?
So just around most of the energy is within something like the radius of the star.
Okay, that's what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah. And this is where you deposit most of the energy.
Okay. Let's say. The light cylinder.
Yeah. But you don't have almost no energy. So. First, let's talk about the giant flare that was observed. It was observed on December 27, a very bad date for an observer. Everyone was in a holiday. But anyway, this was a date. And it was the flare itself, I think, was almost true, was the brightest gamma ray event observed on Earth ever, at least measured. And it was so bright that it saturated all the gamma ray detectors, which were supposed to measure gamma rays in orbit. The duration of the spike was about 0.2 seconds. And at the beginning, just when it was observed, there were only lower limits on the energy that was emitted in the spike. Later on, it turned out that it was possible to extract the energy and also part of the spectrum of this flare by using particle detectors on RISI and on SOPA. And the response of the particle detectors was about 1 erg per centimeter squared. It's a huge amount of energy. And if we take the distance to this magnetar, the source of this flare, to be 15 kiloparsec, it turns out to be an isotropic energy 3 times 10 to the 46 Hertz, close to the total energy budget that we have in this, at least in the exterior magnetic field of this object. I would just say that the distance to this SGR is not 100% confirmed. We know definitely that it is a distance larger than 6 kiloparsec. There are good evidence that it is indeed associated with a very rich star-forming region at a distance of 15 kiloparsec, and through the talk I will assume 15 kiloparsec at a distance. What about the spectrum? And this is actually a very important point about this flare. The spectrum turned out to be consistent with the black body spectrum. Now, the particle detectors are sensitive only above 50 kiloelectron volt, and therefore they do not really see the Rayleigh Jeans part of the spectrum. Nevertheless, both Hurley et al. And Palmer et al. See an exponential decay at a few hundred kV, and Hurley even claimed that this is consistent with the black body spectrum. Namely, probably this flare was thermal. I would just say that before this measurement was published, we estimated the energy emitted in the flare by based on the reflection from the moon. The reflection of the it was so bright that a Russian satellite, Corona F, measured the reflection of the flare from the moon. And we used this reflection in order to estimate the amount of energy in the flare. And it was fully consistent with the results published later. One more point, Eichler, in 2002, predicted that this kind of flares would exist. Eichler's line of thinking was that if we see the mini giant flares, which give a large scale reconnection in the star, there is no reason why we cannot have a global reconnection of all the dipole field, for example. If you take the star and rotate it 180 degrees, this was Eichler's idea. And in this case, you can produce this kind of giant flare. And he said the paper was the name of the paper was Waiting to the Big One. Now, he predicted that this kind of event can occur only once or maybe twice in a lifetime of such a magnetar. And therefore, we'll get to this point. We'll talk about the rates of these events.
Which one was this? What's the name of this source?
1806 minus 20.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Now, this is some preliminary results. We didn't work out all the details yet. But right after the flare, Derek Fox, Terafini, and I requested the observation from Chandra to look for dust echoes, namely for scattering of X-rays by the dust. There are many molecular clouds between us and this source. This source is just on the other side of the galaxy if you look towards the center of the galaxy with some offset. And we hope to see many beautiful rings expanding to learn about the flare and about the intervening media. As it turned out, well, the flare itself was at 5 degrees from the sun. So we had a constraint. Chandra couldn't observe the source up to 40 days after the flare. And 40 days later, it was too late, it turned out. We didn't see anything. All we see is noise. And what you can do with this noise is actually put a limit on the amount of X-ray emitted, assuming that we can trust the molecular the positioning and the opacity of the molecular clouds as found by a radio observation. There is a paper by Kobel and Nickenberry giving all the molecular clouds on the way. And using it, we put an upper limit on the X-ray emission. And you can see here, this is the upper limit. This is a black body found by Herleiter. This is a power law with an exponential decay found by Palmertar as a spectrum of the flare. This is just to illustrate an optically thin Bremsstrahlung. And you can see that, again, probably a black body is fully consistent with the upper limits that we find, and probably the spectrum is more or less similar to a black body, both in the exponential part and in the radiation part. Okay, so this is the initial spike. I will not talk about the pulsating tail, also it's very interesting. It is not entirely relevant for my talk. The next important observation coming from this burst, from this flare, is the radio afterglow. So it took 1 week for the VLA to respond to the idea that this is indeed something interesting. And only after 1 week, there was the first observation, and a gigantic source, almost one Jansky, was found in the place where the flare took off. It was detected by our group in Caltech, published in Cameron et al., and soon after by Gensler et al. And the source was quite interesting. First, it was dissolved. The size of the source, assuming a distance of 15 kiloparsec, was 10 to the 16 centimeter, and it was expanding. It was moving at a velocity of half c. Taylor et al. Started a campaign measuring the size and the position of the source over a long time, and it seems like the source is a one-sided jet with some opening angle moving in one direction at a velocity. The center of the emitting region is moving at a velocity of about half c. It is coasting for about 30 days and then start decelerating. And if we estimate what is the energy in this emitting region, the most conservative minimum energy consideration, given that this source is most likely a synchrotron source, we also see polarization from this source, give a lower limit of 3 × 10³ ergs. Now, and this is a minimal energy possible. A more detailed modeling of the emission, including the deceleration of the emitting material, etc., done by Granot et al., suggest that the maximal the minimal energy is 5 × 10⁴, and it can easily be 10⁴ or even 10⁴ ergs in the region that emits the afterglow. Another point pointed out by Granot et al. Is that if we make some assumption about the external medium, namely that the external medium was homogeneous, at least before it was interacting with the SGR, then the material that we observe after a week was ejected from the source at a velocity of 0.5 c. This is an important question. We do not really know whether this velocity is the velocity after interacting with some external medium. We do not know what happens in the initial week. Maybe it was ejected at relativistic velocity and then decelerating. We do not know. But if the density was constant, then the ejection velocity was also 0.5 c. Now, the first question that I would like to address is, what is the source of the afterglow energy? We're interested in this point in a paper that we published with Ramsari and published with Ramsari and Spipiran. And basically, we revisited the fireball, which was mostly discussed in the context of gamma ray bursts, with the modifications required for this object, and most importantly, questioning how much energy we have in the electrons in the fireball. This is exactly what I'm going to discuss. But before, let's look at the following reasoning of the mechanism of GRBs. In GRB, in the SGR, we had a prompt flash of gamma rays and then extended fireball, extended afterglow. And then, therefore, we can think, okay, probably the mechanism that works for GRB is also the mechanism working here. Now, how do we find, what is the line of reasoning that led to the mechanism of GRB? In GRBs, we observe very high luminosity. This luminosity is coming over a short time scale, and it comes by hard, namely MeV photons, in a non-thermal spectrum. Now, these three ingredients giving us the following model, in which we have a compact source. The size of the compact source is related to the shortest time scale variability that we observe. And then, in order to avoid a very high opacity for gamma for gamma-gamma production, which is needed in order to see a non-thermal spectrum with this kind of high luminosity, we need some mode in which we deposit or originate the energy in the source. But later on, this energy is converted to some form of relativistic wind. This relativistic wind can be baryonic, it can be pairs, it can be a pointing flux. We do not know. In the grand picture, it is not really important. Now, this relativistic wind have to dissipate somewhere in order to produce the energy that we observe, and have to be done at a radius which is large enough, so it will be optically thin for gamma rays. Therefore, we need some dissipation mechanism. It can be internal shocks, it can be electromagnetic instabilities, depending on the nature of the flow, whatever. Now, this kind of dissipation will probably not be 100% efficient. So some of the energy will be dissipated into gamma rays. There will still have some energy remaining in the form of relativistic motion. This energy will later be driven into the external medium and produce the afterglow. Okay, so this is a line of reasoning of the basic model for GRBs, and you can play with the different ingredients, internal, external shocks, pointing flux, baryonic flow, whatever. But this is what you need in order to see all these three ingredients. What is happening in the SGR? Is it indeed have to have a GRB mechanism, or maybe even exactly the opposite? Now, the main difference, at least according to the observations that we have right now from this giant flare, is the fact that these are hard photons, but they are thermal. And if they are thermal, then we have the source, which we believe to be very different, at least from the source of long gamma ray burst, in which we think that this is an accretion on a black hole. But we do not need a relativistic wind, because we do not need the energy deposited on the near the source to be optically thin. If we do not need relativistic wind, we of course do not need to dissipate the energy in this relativistic wind. And if we do not have a relativistic wind and not dissipation of this wind, then where is the energy of the afterglow coming from? It is not clear. Now, I would just say that when I say that there is no relativistic wind, I mean that most of the energy is not ejected from the source in the form of relativistic material or quantum flux. Okay? So this is, there might be some particles moving at relativistic velocity away from the source, but they do not carry most of the energy. So in order to try and figure out what is the evolution of the energy from the point that it is deposited on the surface of the star, we can go back to an idea suggested by Paczynski and Goodman in 1986. This was actually the first fireball model discussed in the literature. And it seems quite adequate to discuss what we have in this case. So if we take a very large amount of energy, luminosity, and we deposit it in a very small radius, like here, it can take about 10 to the 47 ergs per second, deposit it around the surface of a neutron star at a distance of about 10 kilometers, the opposite for gamma-gamma ray production, if this energy deposited in pairs or in gamma rays, is very high. 10 to the 11, it might be modified by a few orders of magnitude by the very high magnetic field. It nevertheless will be much larger than 1. Now, what is happening for this kind of energy? It produces a pure plasma fireball in thermal equilibrium, and this fireball is starting to expand. Now, the temperature of the fireball at the point nearby the star when the velocity is still mildly relativistic is about 300 keV with the parameters which are relevant for our problem, which is very close to the temperature observed in this specific burst. Now the plasma starts expanding under its own pressure. It starts accelerating each point, and it's accelerating in, we assume here, spherical symmetry. The Lorentz factor is increasing rapidly, linearly with the radius. Now the temperature in the rest frame, so at each plasma rest frame, the temperature goes down, and it goes down like 1 over the radius. Now the temperature is observed for an observer at infinity is actually temperature at the rest frame times the Lorentz factor of the fireball, which is a constant. As a result, in this kind of evolution, if all we have is photons and pairs, observer at infinity will see a thermal spectrum. It actually will be a quasi-thermal. It will not be entirely thermal because during the evolution of the fireball, it's near the point where the photosphere becoming optically thin, the emerging photons will deviate slightly from a thermal spectrum, but not much. And the temperature, which will be related to this thermal spectrum, is similar to the temperature that we had at the base of the flow. Okay? Now, the fact that we observe temperature which relate to an area that seems, which is similar to the area on the surface of the neutron star, suggests strongly that indeed what we observe is deposit of energy at this radius. Now, how much energy do we have in this process, and how can we produce the energy? How can we carry the energy outside in order to produce the afterglow? So the first natural candidate would be the pairs. Now, at the beginning, we have pairs and photons. The fireball expands. The pairs annihilate. But at some point, they freeze out, just like in the Big Bang. And when they freeze out, it happens at a radius which is about 20 times R naught, Lorentz factor of about 20. We can calculate how much pairs do we have. So we calculated how much pairs do we have. And then we can see what is the final Lorentz of this final Lorentz factor of these pairs. It is turned out that they freeze out at this radius. At this radius, also, the photons decouples from the pairs, in the sense that every photon from this point on is traveling to infinity without annihilating by any other photon or without scattering with any electron or positron. However, the pairs at this point do not decouple from the photons. There are so many more photons that each electron or positron is continued to be heated by many photons and being accelerated actually to a much higher Lorentz factor. And calculating the Lorentz factor, it turns out that the pairs decouple from the radiation at a radius which is about 1,000 times the initial radius, and a final Lorentz factor of about 700. Now, it's possible to calculate what is the energy that remains in these pairs, and it is a constant fraction of the initial energy, regardless of what the initial energy is, and it is about 10 to the minus 5 the initial energy with this radius. So the answer is definitely no. The energy, there will be some energy emitted as relativistic wind with a very high Lorentz factor from the source, but the energy will be negligible compared to the energy that we observe in this afterglow. Now, a very high magnetic field may change these two numbers. It may change the optical depth for the photons. It may change the cross-section for annihilation. But it always works in the other direction. It actually only reduces, if we have a very high magnetic field, it only reduces the final Lorentz factor of the final energy in the pair. Therefore, regardless of the fact that a very high magnetic field might change the evolution slightly, it will not change the result. There is no enough energy in the pairs. So what can we do? We can do what people did in order to extend gamma ray bursts. They started adding baryons to this pure fireball. And the baryon is supposed to take out the energy. So you can see here the evolution of the fireball in terms of what is the final Lorentz factor and the final energy of such a fireball when adding baryons to the fireball. So what you see here, this is a Lorentz factor, and this is a green line. This is the final energy, final kinetic energy in the relativistic component. And this is energy, it's normalized to the energy that we observe in this flare, 10 to the 46 ergs. And this is the baryon loading. It's going from, this is a low baryon loading, and this is a high baryon loading. So when there is a very low baryon loading, this is a pair-dominated fireball. The baryons do not play any role. If we start adding baryons, it changes around the point where the mass of the baryons is comparable to the mass of the pairs. And the baryons affect the evolution in two ways. They add to the inertia, and the electron that accompanies to the protons add also to the opacity. From this point on, if we add baryons from here all the way up to here, we would not get into the details, the Lorentz factor is going down, later becoming constant, and the energy that we have in this baryon is going up until this point where actually the baryons take all the energy that we have in the in the photons into the relativistic motion of the baryon. Now, sorry, for GRBs, this is the relevant part. From here and on. In GRBs, we do not see thermal photons. We see only the dissipation of the baryons, if indeed this is a baryonic flow. And therefore, in a fireball model for GRBs, the baryonic loading should be such that all the energy is transferred to the baryon. So we are in this part when all the energy is here. And the Lorentz factor is actually limited. So the baryonic loading in GRBs is limited to be between this point and the point when the Lorentz factor drops to 100. Because we know that the final Lorentz factor of the baryons is 100. If we put too many baryons and we'll give all this energy to the baryons, then the final Lorentz factor will not be high enough. So this is a fine-tuning baryonic problem for fireballs of GRBs, if you heard about it. In our case, we want most of the energy to emerge in the thermal photons. And therefore, we need to be below this point. I will just say that the temperature of the photons emerging after this point is dropping fastly with the baryonic loading. NP here is the number of baryons, number of protons. Okay? So we need to be below this point, less baryons than needed to transfer all the energy to the relativistic motion, and above this point. This is the minimal energy observed in the afterglow. And therefore, it is possible in principle to carry the energy out by adding some amount of baryons to the fireball. This amount of baryons can vary over three orders of magnitude, between something like several times 10 to the 20 grams to several times 10 to the 23 grams, and still have a thermal spectrum in the flash and enough energy in the afterglow. Now, note that the final Lorentz factor during all this region would be very high. It will be higher than 100. So if this is a mechanism that carries the energy out to the afterglow, the Lorentz factor is very high. Now, we checked also other possibilities, and we will not go through all the possibilities. We saw that the pairs cannot energize the afterglow. We also checked whether an interaction between the radiation and the external medium itself is will convert enough energy, will transfer enough energy into the external medium in order to energize the afterglow, and the answer is no. We need a very controversial external density to do it. Then, just what I said before, some tuned baryonic load can do it, although I must say that I do not like this solution. It seems a bit artificial to have the right amount of baryons in order to explain the afterglow. When we started this work, we actually hoped that the pairs will do it, but they didn't. Now, if the energy is ejected at the velocity of 0.5c, as suggested by Granot et al., then this cannot be a solution. We need the line of sight to be free, because as we said, if we have a fine-tuned baryon loading, the final Lorentz factor is very high. So this is not a solution for an ejector which goes at the 0.5c. However, the solution might be simply an angular fluctuation, a strong angular fluctuation in the amount of baryon loadings. And then we have a line of sight which is baryonic free, and we observe just the emission. And then in other directions, the baryonic loading is very high, much higher than needed in order to convert all the energy in the radiation to kinetic energy of the baryon. And this part, and this is where the energy of the afterglow is coming from. I must say that I do not like all this, all these solutions. So I do not think that we have an adequate solution to the component that energizes the afterglow. It is not similar component to the one which is working in GRB. One hint that might come that might help here is that 0.5c is the escape velocity from the surface of the neutron star. So. Well, I heard one idea which might be nice, but it was not worked out and not published out, and it's not mine, so I hope that we'll find it on the web one day. So this is more or less the current situation with the question where the afterglow coming from, and with the fact that probably the mechanism at work here is not similar to one working Jarvis. Now to the second question. What is the rate of giant flares or extragalactic flares as short GRBs? It is completely different topic. So we observed one giant flare. Giant flare is I took it as flare with more than 10 to the 46 Hertz. And it was observed within 30 years. Okay, so we will say the rate is 1 per 30 years per Milky Way galaxy or per 4 soft gamma ray repeaters. If we take account also for the uncertainty, for the Poisson uncertainty of one event, we find out that the rate is between 1 per 5 years and 1 per 1,300 years. And this is if we take an interval of 95%. Now, if we consider the fact that there are 4 SGRs in our galaxy, then the rate is something between 1 per 20 years to 1 per 5,000 years, with a proportional number of 1 per 120 years. And as pointed out by Stella et al., if the rate is 1 per 100 years, then within the lifetime of an SGR, there are 10 to 100 such events. Much more energy is released in this kind of flares than there is in the external magnetic field. And in order to explain this kind of rate, one needs to replenish the energy of the magnetic field in the external magnetic field in some way. And some source to do it might be an internal magnetic field, which is much higher. So he postulated that the energy in the internal magnetic fields should be 10 to the 16 or 13 to the 17 erg, and this magnetic field is replenishing the external magnetic field, and this external magnetic field annihilate, and every 100 years the same thing. Okay. Now, actually, we can test we can estimate the rate of SGRs not only based on this one event, and the reason is that the initial spike of this flare can be detected up to 50 megaparsec by BATSIM. These are hard gamma rays. The luminosity is high enough and up to a distance of 50 megaparsecs, there are many galaxies in this distance, we can detect these flares. Now, if we estimate what is the rate of these flares for BATSI, given on the detection and the distance, and we find out that if we assume that the rate per Milky Way galaxy is 1 per 30 years, the rate, observed rate of similar SGRs supposed to be 150 per year. A very large number. This is a whole sky, so BATSI didn't observe the whole sky, but BATSI is supposed to detect 70 or 80 such flares every year. But let's say that BATSI indeed observes this kind of this rate of flares from SGRs. What it will cause them? It will cause them short GRBs. They look just like short GRBs, except for the fact that short GRBs are non-thermal. But if we allow ourselves to relax this assumption, this to relax the requirement for the spectrum, and maybe other SGRs, giant flares, are non-thermal, then it turns out that actually the whole population of short GRBs might be these SGRs. And at the point where the SGR was exploded observed, we didn't have the observations that we have today from SWIFT, and indeed many people thought that this might be the solution. Now, today we know that it is not a solution, and then we would like to know what is the fraction of short GRBs, of our observation of short GRBs, objects we call short GRBs, that actually originate in this kind of flares. So just when the flare was observed, and before we had SWIFT data, we examined six error boxes of short GRBs, old error boxes updated by the IPN, and we found that none of these short GRBs can be originating in a nearby galaxy, such galaxy that that the energy at the distance of this galaxy will be comparable to 10 to the 46 or 10 to the 47 ergs, and therefore we concluded that at least these six GRBs are not flares from SGR, which give us some limit of about. So we knew that not all short GRBs are SGRs. Today, the situation is slightly better. We have about 14 GRBs. One of them might be, and I think that actually probably is, a flare from an SGR. One of the short GRBs observed this year is coming from the vicinity of M82 and M81. And the energy of the flare, if it's coming, it's a distance of 4 megaparsecs. The energy of the flare, if it is originating in these galaxies, is 10 to the 47 ergs. The light curve is quite similar to the light curve observed in SGR flares, which is slightly different, well, at least by the eye, than typical light curve of short GRB. If we take this fraction to be the observed fraction, then we know that the limiting fraction of SGRs out of the short GRBs population is 30%, and if we take the fact that we observed one in 30 years, 95% confidence level, the fraction is larger than 1%. Now, OFEC examined IPN localization of 46 short GRBs. So he went to the IPN and actually looked not only at error boxes but also at analysis, and looked for nearby galaxies within 20 megaparsecs that coincide with this, that intersect this error boxes or analyzed. And he found that only one out of these 46 short GRBs may be a giant flare. This implies that the rate, that the fraction of the fraction, it's not published yet, but I guess it will be published soon. It implies that the fraction is smaller than 14%, and if we take 14% out of the whole short GRB population as a rate, and we interpret it as a rate per SGR, assuming that a typical galaxy has the same number of SGRs that we have in the Milky Way, it turns out that the rate is smaller than 5,000 years per SGR, but larger than about 1,000. And this rate is actually quite comfortable for the magnetar model. It's once or twice in a lifetime of an SGR. We do not need much higher energy in order to replenish the external magnetic field, and well, I don't know if everyone, but several people at least will be happy. Then I would like to, before I conclude, I would like to raise some speculative question. If you have any ideas on this point, I would be happy. This is something that came up in discussion to have with Todd Thompson. And the question is, can we exclude the possibility that some kind of exotic SGRs with 10 to the 17 Gauss, which is the upper limit of the magnetic field one can, that is allowed, can actually be the progenitors of all short GRBs? So maybe all GRBs are coming from SGRs, not the same one that we observe, but just the same phenomena scaled up in the energy. Now, the question is not, do we think that this is the true answer, but whether we can exclude it in a very confident way. And I'm not sure. We have several, this kind of progenitor should answer several observational facts that we have about short GRBs. First, the progenitors are old. They're not associated with young star-forming regions, and therefore it cannot be an end product of a core collapse supernovae. But as suggested by Levaneta, it might be, for example, that SGRs are originating from a merger of two white dwarfs, for example. In this case, it is perfectly fine to find them in ellipticals and in a non-star-forming region. So there might be some other channel in which SGR is produced. Then we need to originate something like 10 to the 51, 10 to the 50 ergs in this explosion. So the magnetic field should be higher, as I said before, about 10 to the 16 or 10 to the 17 Gauss.
Do we really need that much energy for the short bursts? I thought it was less. I get different numbers every time.
The first burst observed, the first redshift detected, it was 10 to the 48. Then it was something like 10 to the 49. And it continues to go up. The burst observed at December 21st was at a ratio of 0.5, isotropic equivalent energy several times 10 to the 51. And the light curve, the optical light curve, didn't show a break for quite a long time. So even if there is some opening angle, it's not very wide. It's not very narrow. So at least in this case, the total energy supposed to be would be at least 10 to the 50
arcs. So are the short bursts really, there's a wide range of energies in short bursts?
It seems like it. At least the isotropic energy, definitely. For the isotropic energy, we have four bursts and about two or three orders of magnitude in the amount of energy. Yeah.
Yeah.
We have only four bursts with four or five bursts with known redshift for which we have isotropic energy and it range between 10 to the 48 to 10 to the 51. Yeah, so we definitely need something like 10 to the 50 ergs here. Maybe 10 to the 51 is too high, but even if we need only 10 to the 49 ergs, we need a 10 to the 16 Gauss magnetic field, which is not the one observed, at least inferred for the magnetars that we do observe in our galaxy.
The one that was 10 to the 48 ergs, could that have been actually a stronger burst than we saw off some axis? Or, I mean, so but the reason I'm fine to say that there's one at 10 to the 50, but there's one at 10 to the 48, and I can't, that's isotropic. I can't beam it and get it up. You know, it's down there.
Yeah.
Is there any way that it could not have been, you know, could it have been a stronger explosion that we just... Is there any way of bringing its energy up, or is it definitely a couple orders of magnitude dimmer than...
Well, it might be... it do not show some of the indications that you would expect from an off-axis burst. For example, it was very short. If you take two orders of magnitudes in the energy, you should take one order of magnitude in the duration. It should be longer.
The reason I care is that if I believe in the neutron star merger paradigm, it's not like the collapse star paradigm where I can imagine a lot of different energies because stars are all different. These neutron stars aren't all that different, so why do some produce more and some less?
It seems like it's like the at least the isotropic energy variance is similar to the isotropic energy variance that you observe in long GRBs.
Okay. Yes, the long GRBs I expect.
Yeah, no, this is observational fact.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't expect anything. This is what we observe.
That
we have four bursts and three orders of magnitude. As far as how, what is the total energy, I'm not sure. It might be that this is was a burst observed somewhat off-axis. Maybe it was not off-axis, maybe it was on-axis, but maybe the amount of energy emitted in different directions is very different. Yeah. We had 10 to 48 going towards us and 10 to 51 going in another direction. And it might also be the case in this. The efficiency also might play, if you have a very different efficiency in different parts of the firewall, of the emitting region, it might also play an important role which will not be detected in the afterglow evolution.
Well, it doesn't only have to be an inside black hole coalescence, in which case you're back to having some
efficiency. Yeah, then, but that's what it would push me to. I mean, that's why I was...
If you have two neutron stars, and the internal field in the neutron star is already big, and then you get differential rotation on the merge, you get to 10 to 17, you're not surprised.
Yeah.
Okay.
10 to 16. I think some Russians have a more emerging neutron stars.
At that point, if there's a big diversity in the burst, then I would want it to be something like, you know, different neutron stars with different magnetic fields would have different burst energies, and that would be a better way.
Well, there may be a no-memory aspect, because once you start merging these things, some dynamo might enter, and so it may at that point no longer matter how you start out within the 40, within the 50, it just merges to some maximum magnetic field strength. So it's not clear.
They all saturate in the same field.
Yeah, that may be possible. So you have a no-memory issue.
Yeah, but that's what I don't want.
Well, what you want or not,
but I can't imagine. If you have very high magnetic field, wouldn't it be very important in the evolution? And maybe the evolution would be different from magnetic field, which is built up by a dynamo, which will be on small scales, and maybe the evolution would be very different, even if the final magnetic field would not be different.
Well, the issue is that I think that most of these neutron stars that are emerging are not 10 to the 15, they're 10 to the 12. Yeah. And so then the magnetic field won't play a role. And so maybe this, I don't know. I mean, if I were just grasping, I'd say the one that was very energetic happened to be some very energetic neutron stars when they were emerging, and so it changed the structure. And then but I would then want most of them to be moving.
But wouldn't you expect some kind of a partition between the magnetic field and the other energies when the thing is merging?
Yeah, but the kinetic energy is in the rotation, for example. That's what I'm saying. So it might just push itself towards a natural called partition, right? Some natural, which then becomes standard because it's set by the masses.
Yeah. There are also numerical simulations, I think, by Rosberg, which indicated this is what happened.
Yeah. Well, there are many angles which suggest that.
Yeah. I saw there were some Russians who had this model of two neutron stars producing magnetic effects producing the
I still think this Nusikov is a good source for a gigantic radio burst, but whether they make a short GRB, I'm not so sure.
No, in this kind of model, you want one isolated, which is just doing same flare as the one that we observed. Now, another point is that we do not detect these guys in our galaxy, but this can be understood by the fact that the lifetime would be very short with this kind of magnetic field, therefore no problem at this point. But two questions which look suspicious with this kind of event is first the non-thermal spectrum. Short GRBs are non-thermal, almost all of them, or maybe all, but for most of them we have a good constraint, and therefore it should be non-thermal. And then the time scale. The time scale in the giant flares of this SGR, of the SGR that we know, is 10 to the 15 Gauss. The time scale, the duration of the flare, relate to the Alphen crossing time of the interior. If the magnetic field is much higher, then the Alphen crossing time will be much shorter. So what do we relate this half second or 0.1 second that we observe in short GRBs to? I don't know. Maybe there is something. Yes. I do not pretend that I understand this kind of object. And then short and long GRBs are very similar in many senses. Both in the spectrum and the temporal properties, the short timescale temporal properties of short GRBs and long GRBs are very similar, which pushing, at least for me, seems like a kind of indication that maybe the inner engine is similar for these two events. If there are two very different And also the afterglow seems to be similar with the energy. So I don't know. I would be more happy with a similar engine. So just to conclude, somebody predicted a giant flare from SGR. It was Eichler, and it was indeed observed, and there are such events. So this is one very interesting thing that we learned from this event. Then I think that we were quite lucky to observe one. The rate is about 1 per 3,000 years and for an SGR, and about 1 per 1,000 years or per 800 years in our galaxy. So we had less than 10% to observe one, but sometimes we are lucky. Also, the observed behavior of the SGR giant flare is quite similar to GRB. The mechanism and the evolution of the energy once it is originating the source is probably quite different than what is happening for GRB. The line of sight, in this case, I think that the thermal spectrum with the right temperature corresponding to the size of the neutron star, suggesting strongly that the line of sight was a baryonic free. And these are few of the results about the that might explain the energy in the afterglow. I told you before, I do not really fond of any one of them. Well, maybe this one. Thank you very much.
This flare of the first SDR ever seen, there was the one in the LMC in the
79. Yeah.
Yeah, that was not a giant flare.
It was what I call the mini giant flare. It had 10 to the 44 ergs. Both previous flares, unfortunately, we do not know if they were thermal or not. The fits. So the spectrum that people fitted to this burst was not thermal. But then again, the data was not very good. Again, most of the detectors were saturated. There were not so many at this time. And it might be that the spectrum is consistent, the thermal spectrum. And in one of them also, we have only a lower limit on the energy. So maybe the energy in this mini giant flare was even higher than 10 to the 44 hertz. I would just say another thing. The flare in 98 have shown an afterglow as well. So the afterglow was detected also for a giant flare, so for a mini giant flare occurred in 98. It was detected by Shri and Dale. And it was 500 times fainter than the radio afterglow observed in this flare. So this is another indication. I didn't go through this point, but some question which might be interesting is whether the flare is beamed or not. Maybe we see 10 to the 46 hertz in our direction, but in other directions, nothing. And we have several indications that it is not the case. One of them is this radio emission, so the energy in the afterglow. But another one is the fact that we do not see what we call orphan tails. So I remind you that after the initial spike, there was a long X-ray tail lasting several hundred seconds. This tail, although it was much fainter than the spike itself, can be detected easily. And it is coming, the model for this flare is what is called confined fireball. It's believed to be plasma confined by the magnetic field nearby the surface of the star. And the period that we observe is just the rotation, of course, of the star. And this kind of emission is not beamed. Therefore, the beaming of the spike and the beaming of the tail should be comparable, and therefore the spike is probably not beamed. So, probably the energy here is indeed two orders of magnitude larger than in previous events.
This velocity of 0.5 c, what's that based on?
You just see, you just observe the emitting region, you resolve it. Mm-hmm. So you see a blob, you see the size, and you see the direction, you see the polarization, you see it moving, everything. It's beautiful paper by Taylor et al. Just, and they still following this object.
It fits very well with a strong wind from a neutron star, because the wind will have typically the escape velocity from the surface.
What do you mean by a strong wind?
Well, produce all these pairs and whatever, there is a whole, you produce a whole atmosphere basically in the magnetic sphere, and then yeah, these particles will if they have more than space energy, then they will just go. They're like a stellar wind, they will just have.
Yes, but
the velocity is in the escape velocity.
But would they have enough energy? This is a question. Yeah, this is what I said. If anything is escaping in some kind of I don't know, by pressure or something, you would expect it to have the escape velocity. This is why I said that 0.5c might be a good clue. Yeah, but the question is whether you can have enough energy in this kind of wind. Maybe yes. Maybe the answer is yes. This would be a much better... if the energy in the wind is linear and comparable to the energy in the flare, then you have a solution. We have now two flares with two afterglows. The energy is related, more or less linearly. This would be a good solution.
We have a program here in this institute about what you like, which Christian Kupriyot and some other people organized 7 years ago on the software and computers.
I think I just was at the meeting, wasn't it?
So there were some of these wind models.
There hasn't been any optical afterglow, it seems.
No. Nothing was observed in the optical. Actually, it was optically thin in the radio when it was observed after a week. Mm-hmm. So you would not expect to have a bright optical emission at this time. Also, I didn't say, but you would not detect this radio afterglow from extragalactic flare. So while the spike is observable, the same radio afterglow, it's at 15 kiloparsecs, one Jansky. You take it to something like 10 megaparsec, it is micro Jansky. So maybe, I don't know, maybe it was much brighter at earlier time, but... There is maybe an IR counterpart, and maybe it is actually the source itself is observed in IR. So people looked in infrared and see something which might be the source itself. But that's it. No afterglow or anything like this.
So the issue is they didn't get the radio right after. It was
bureaucracy of the VLA. Yeah. This is what I heard. Okay, I do not know. I was not the one asking for the time, but it was.
And the rate of these are essentially one in the lifetime of the VLA kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they had one in the lifetime chance, and they.
And they, yeah. Yeah, well, it was Christmas.
That's it.
Yeah. it took them 1 week to convince the VLA that this is important enough.
So there was no set absorption peak observed. Was it
observed
with the GMRT?
So you can see, yes, actually. But only later, only after the detection. What you can see here, not see, well, I put it, but these points are, it's 200 megahertz, something like this. Okay, and you can see at any given time, you can see, yeah, this is a low frequency, this is high frequency.
The top one is 200
megahertz? I just took that. Yeah, it's with the GMRT. Oh. 200 or 400 megahertz, but it's less than gigahertz. And it's go all the way, this is 8 gigahertz, the last point. This is 8 gigahertz, so you have 8, 5, 1, and all these are below megahertz, below gigahertz.
So it's brightest in the
low frequency. It's optically
thin. Oh, that's very nice.
It's optically thin. After a week, it was optically thin. Yeah, yeah. And the spectrum was new to the -7, 0.7, so on. Well, a typical synchrotron optically thin spectrum. It was polarized. Yeah, the polarization went away after some time.
I mean, if you had detected a PGU, you have a magnetic field.
Yeah.
That's
it's
really a shame.
Yeah.
Bureaucracy.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, the colors were changing with time, and also the slope.
And the spectral index is changing, is it?
Well, which spectrum?
I'm just looking at all the different light curves. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing scaled, yeah.
It's not the same?
It's not the same thing scaled along, you know.
No. The colors are changing. The colors are changing. But not significantly. Go to -1, to -0.7. Both the time, and also there are some breaks here. And well, I didn't. There is a much longer light curve. I didn't plot it. But actually, the time in which you see here the deceleration in the size. So you actually the deceleration in the motion. There is also a bump in the light curve. So this is what Granat is using in order to claim that this is a deceleration time, 30 days. So up to 30 days, you actually see a plasmon. Just expanding, freely expanding, emitting a plasma blob, and at 30 days you start seeing the interaction of this plasmon with the external medium, and you have a component of a forward shock going in forward, and producing the emission after 30 days.